Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 12, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is the presenter, Tom Kennedy. Today's session number is 98-8, and it is titled, Forgiveness and Cheap Grace. Let's listen in.
We celebrate the legacy of Orville Redenbacher every year. Annual popcorn festival, which includes a race in the morning called the Popcorn Panic, which I believe Mark Schwein is likely to be running in. And if miracles of a certain type happen, which I think we can typically don't happen, I'll be running in that as well. I think it's around the second week of September or something like that, so you can go to your ordinary Labor Day festivities and then a short time later.
You run carrying a pan of popping corn?
I think actually they've got a little race, a race for the smaller people called the Little Colonel Race. Maybe they do that.
Is there an old man?
Yeah, I was going to say.
I don't know. Again, I know some of you are as tired of this as I am, but I feel obligated to the bookstore to do this at least one more time. Not many more times. Oh. The bookstore really would like to help you out and help themselves out all in the process by allowing you to purchase this splendid text. It's called From Christ to the World, Introductory Readings in Christian Ethics. I suggested that they might want to have a few on hand this summer, knowing how valuable this is to every church library as well as every personal library.
How much is it?
It's a ridiculously low price, actually. This is about almost 600 pages of double column. Astonishing. And it's a very attractive cover.
It would cost you thousands to run down all those sources.
It would. You can bet on that. Only $30.
And did they over-order?
If no one buys any, you don't get any. If you do your duty, for all I know, they're already sold out, but I'll get this back over there soon so you can reserve your copy. Today's session is the third independent or discrete session in a series called Reading Goodness, in which what we're doing is we're using texts, literary texts typically, to encourage us as a jumping off point in thinking about various aspects of morality and the moral life, of being good and what it means to be a good person, or to try to be a good person. Specifically, today's topic is forgiveness and cheap grace. It's a challenging and vexing topic, maybe much more complex and mysterious once you actually start thinking about it carefully than if you don't. So that may be a downside to this session. It may complicate matters for us in a way we surprised us even complicated. The goal in the session is simply this, to have us think more carefully and clearly about forgiveness and what goes on in the process of forgiveness. Other texts to recommend to you, as you have heard almost as many times as you've heard me promote this wonderful text, which is available for $30. The theme for this summer's Guide Our Feet, and the text they're using for that is a book co-edited, collection of essays co-edited by Dorothy Bass. And one of the essays in there is by Greg Jones, who teaches at now he's the dean of Duke Divinity School. He's got an essay on forgiveness. Now, I'll have to confess, I read that essay some time ago. I haven't reread it recently. So here's good news for you. You can always consult that after the session, and no doubt come out better than if you hadn't consulted it. But I assume that's the case. Well, right, what are we doing today? Well, I suggest that we get into the question of forgiveness by means of asking a series of at least three questions, and then we'll no doubt ask many more questions. But a series of three questions provoked and promoted by certain literary texts. But before we do that, it's good that we agree on some vocabulary. Last night in the session, I think people were suspicious of my vocabulary, but never mind that. This is today. So, here are some key terms or concepts we're going to be operating with today. Just two simple terms or concepts: virtue and vice. Probably language that we don't use very much anymore. Maybe, in fact, language that we associate with Victorian culture. But we shouldn't. They're good, important concepts and terms. So, by virtue, what I have in mind when I talk about a virtue, I take virtue to be a disposition, a tendency to act or feel a certain sort of way. All right? So the first thing to notice is that the possession of a virtue disposes us, inclines us sometimes to act in a certain way. So if I've got the virtue of truthfulness, for example, it's sort of second nature for me to tell the truth. If I've got the virtue of truthfulness, it's second nature. I typically don't have to think about it. It just sort of automatically is triggered when someone tells a lie. I feel anger or hostility or disappointment about it. Okay? So what it is to have a virtue is to have character traits that are sort of second nature to one. The person who's genuinely virtuous, who really has the virtue in question, just automatically acts or feels a certain way. Does that make sense to you so far? That seems true to experience, right? The patient person, the person who's genuinely patient, patience seems to be a virtue. The person who's genuinely patient doesn't have to sit down and think a long time about, well, what's the patient thing in this? It's just second nature to her. It just happens. Now, we won't talk so much about how you develop or acquire virtues. A second thing to notice about virtues is that it seems to me they're corrective. That's to say, typically, they fix something about our natures. We're disposed, for example, if truthfulness is a virtue, it's fixing something about our character or natures, that we have a tendency not to tell the truth, that for some reason, telling the truth is often an effort for us. So all the virtues, in some sense, are corrective of some tendency or inclination in human nature. If we weren't disposed to be impatient, patience wouldn't be a virtue. Third thing to notice about virtue is that virtues contribute to flourishing. It seems to me that what we're interested in as human beings is a sort of fulfillment, a sort of human flourishing for us as individuals, as well as for the community. And my suggestion is that we're better off with virtues, we're more likely to flourish with the virtues than we would without them. All right, vice. As a concept, corresponds to virtue. It's just the downside. is virtue, vice-like virtue, is the disposition to act or feel a certain way. But it's the type of disposition that's destructive of human flourishing. Okay, any problem with that conceptual apparatus?
Do you use either one of them as your baseline? Because you use virtue as a corrective, so that would assume the baseline is a negative?
The baseline is either neutral or negative.
Okay.
So corrective, fixing something that's wrong, or improving something that's not there in sufficient amount. I think at least we need not commit ourselves to anything more than that. Well, okay, then the question that arises for us is this. Is being a forgiving person, is having a character of forgivingness, is that a good thing? Is forgivingness a virtue? That's the question, the first question we confront. Now maybe automatically, your first impulse, because you're good people, I can tell. Your first impulse is, well, what a strange question. I mean, of course it is. Well, let's slow down a bit. I'd like to read a passage from a novel by Faye Weldon. The title of the novel is Female Friends. And here's what one of the characters says. Understand and forgive, my mother said, and the effort has quite exhausted me. I could do with some anger to energize me and bring me back to life again. But where can I find that anger? Who's to help me? My friends? I've been understanding and forgiving my friends, my female friends, for as long as I can remember. Understand and forgive. Understand husbands, wives, fathers, mothers. Understand dogfights above and the charity box below. Understand fur-coated women and children without shoes. Understand school, Jonah, Job, and the nature of the deity. Understand Hitler and the Bank of England and the behavior of Cinderella's sisters. Preach acceptance to wives and tolerance to husbands, patience to parents, and compromise to the young. Nothing in this world is perfect. To protest takes the strength needed for survival. Grit your teeth, endure, understand, forgive, accept in the light of your own death, your own inevitable corruption. Oh, mother, what you taught me. And what a miserable, crawling, sniveling way to go. The worn-out slippers neatly placed beneath the bed, careful not to give offense. What does the character seem to be suggesting there?
To forgive is to be a doormat.
Okay.
To forgive is not to confront behavior that is wounding to others.
Okay. It's to condone harmful behaviors.
And forgiveness numbs internally.
Okay. So forgiveness, the suggestion here is that forgiveness can have bad effects upon oneself. Doormat language. Forgiveness is harmful to one's self-respect or self-esteem, numbs one in terms of moral sensitivity, and the result is condoning evil when it's done. Be better off not being forgiving people. Then we would have better respect for ourselves, better respect and protection and adherence to morality. Well, end of class. What are we to make of this? I mean, does this, where do we go from here with the observation that forgiveness can harm us? Forgiveness can lead to harm of others. What do we do with this? Is this And we answered the question there. Forgiveness is not a virtue at all. In fact, it's a vice. Justice is the virtue, and forgiveness is a type of vice that flies in the face of justice. Justice for ourselves, justice for others.
Well, it seems to me, if forgiveness, if the shifting to forgiveness is so rapid that the true feelings of anger and injustice are not felt and then confronted, then forgiveness would be, I guess I'd say that maybe, well, not a, I probably shouldn't use the word cheap grace. It cuts short where maybe energy should be. I think perhaps in our Christian culture we have felt that to feel anger there was the fear that then we would act forth in a violent way. And it's really what we do with the anger. Anger in itself is not bad. It's the actions that come forth from the anger that can be bad. But the actions that can, anger is really energy. And the energy can be used in a positive way.
I'd like to agree with that. And I think, I didn't say anything earlier, but that's where I have a little difficulty with the definition, to use act and feel as the same thing.
Okay, I don't mean them to be the same thing, but I mean to suggest that some of the virtues, that when we think about the moral life and being a good person, being morally excellent, it's not just about what we do, but it's also about how we feel. That they're not only right actions and wrong actions, but they're right feelings and wrong feelings.
I see, I can't go along with that. I think the feelings are neither right nor wrong. They're just there.
Well, okay. Can anyone provide us with a counterexample that will sort of quickly resolve this disagreement for us? The question is, can there be... Are feelings just sort of basically there, neither right nor wrong, or can sometimes feelings be?
It depends on how you act about those feelings, what you do with them.
Yeah, but if you feel hate is that wrong? It's not
hate is an
action. What is a feeling? Hate is not an action.
It's a feeling.
It's a feeling. So, you don't do anything with it.
But if you act out on that hate,
but even
in a violent way.
But okay, let's say that you could see into my character, into my heart right now. And what you could see, if you peeled off this layer, what you could see deep within my soul is a sort of churning and anger and bitterness because things, we're not going where I wanted to go. And so I'm so outraged at anyone who has dared to disagree with my concept. I don't act upon that. Wouldn't your assessment of me be, I'm glad Kennedy doesn't act upon that, but he's not a very good person. If he had the virtue of gentleness and patience, he'd never have felt those things at all.
He needs a little help.
Even if I don't act on them, I need help, right?
Right.
So I think, we can think of lots of examples once we step back. Lots of times in which we become angry at ourselves for feelings we find within us.
Everything is to what degree?
That's right. So the philosopher Aristotle says at one point, the important thing is this whole stuff once we get into it is very complex and complicated. Because really to have the virtue with respect to feelings is feeling the right way at the right time towards the right person in the right set of circumstances. And it's all very complex. So as you suggested earlier, sometimes anger is an appropriate, a virtuous feeling. But if I become filled with anger every time my son doesn't brush his teeth as well as I think he should, That's a character flaw in me. That's a defect. And it's something that's destructive of my flourishing and probably destructive of his flourishing as well. I mean, does that make sense to you, or are you still reluctant?
Well, those so-called negative feelings, if we say that they're a vice, then how do we ever deal with those feelings? If we teach our children, you shouldn't feel that way, you shouldn't be angry,
well,
then we never know how to deal with those feelings.
But wouldn't we want to teach them, I thought her suggestion was, well, you want to teach your kids to be angry at the right time, in the right place, towards the right people for the right time.
Well, I actually really didn't say that.
What I wanted to say was that the anger and one's feelings, whatever one feels, one needs to delay reaction long enough to get more in touch with what those core issues are. Let's say if your child is not doing a good job toothbrushing. Mm-hmm. If it builds up over a period of time, then and those feelings aren't processed, then there can lead to an explosion. So what is you need to defuse that and deal with the situation there.
Yeah.
And maybe not roll into it some child experience you had with an angry father with you not responding, because that's when you get the real whammies.
Would that be in a way sorting out whether your anger at that action is appropriate or not? Mm-hmm. He's saying, you know, why am I so angry? Is it right to be angry here, or is it right to take reasonable action but not be angry? You know, so sorting through whether that's a proper way to be feeling in this instance or not.
I think it's not whether the anger is right or wrong, it's what's the underlying cause. That, you know, are you concerned about the kid's health or dental bills or some
reason? Okay, so it's got to be the feeling towards the right person. So I shouldn't be angry at my wife because my son's not brushing his teeth properly. For the right reason, it shouldn't be because, I mean, something would have misfired if I'm so angry because I'm worried about paying dental bills. That's, I would be concerned about his well-being, not dental bills, and so on. So I think you're all pointing to significant things, that the emotions or feelings are important, but they can misfire on us. So I think typically we think there's going to be a connection between moral health and mental health, that to be morally healthy, to have these virtues, I suggest, will lead, I mean, it ought to lead to a mental health as well. But there might be mistaken ways of achieving mental health at the expense of moral health. And that's connected with forgiveness and forgivingness as well.
There's also a difference between anger as a feeling and anger as a vice. I mean, one is acting out of the disposition of anger. The other is in the midst of even a virtue, you can have anger that causes you to act a certain way along the lines of justice issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're confusing those two things right now. There's an issue of feeling that, yes, is uncontrollable emotions that just bubble out. There's also a sense of anger of our being that we act out of. And I would say those two things have to be distinguished in terms of being a basis of our action and our feelings, or being the feeling. And I would want to separate those two in some capacity.
Okay. When we think about a person who's really virtuous, a moral saint, right? Now, I take it what we think about that person is not only are we able to predict what actions that person will do, but we also are able to predict what feelings she will feel in the presence of certain things she sees. So that's what that's trying to capture. That moral saintliness, that moral goodness, is not just a matter of doing things, You can do all the right actions, but if your feelings aren't in sync with the right actions you perform, then you're not as good a person as you would be were your feelings to be in sync with what's happening. Well, that's a good question, and that's a question we can sidestep for our purposes this morning. But I can tell you what courses back at Valparaiso give you an enrollment for. Okay, you're before my time. That was the problem. All right, so back to the question of forgiveness. Is the person, there's something, initially that text we read suggests there's something wrong with the person who is too ready to forgive, or is ready to forgive things that she didn't do. So for example, too ready to forgive, a mistake could be made in forgiving things that weren't done to oneself, for example. So there are a number of ways to go wrong with forgiveness, we saw. Maybe we can get clearer about the nature, about whether forgiveness is a virtue or a vice by trying to just hold that question open for the time being and think more about the nature of forgiveness. And maybe a way to think more carefully about what forgiveness is to start with a sort of a common phrase we use. On our way out here, we listened to a book on tape, Doris Kearns Goodwin's No Ordinary Time. It's the story of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, and particularly during the war years. Very interesting book, well worth reading. But one of the things that Goodwin quotes Eleanor Roosevelt as saying, as you know, early in the relationship between Franklin and Eleanor, Franklin Roosevelt had an affair. And it was devastating to Eleanor at the time, hurt her very deeply, and affected their relationship the rest of their lives, really. Now, at one point, Eleanor says about Franklin Roosevelt in the affair, she says, she uses language we commonly use. She says, "I forgive Franklin," or "I forgave Franklin, but I cannot forget what he did." Is she mistaken there? Are you mistaken if you think you forgive but don't forget? Are forgiving and forgetting two different things, or is it the case that to forgive is to forget?
To forget is to repress.
Well, not always, right?
It's significant.
Sometimes forgetting just happens.
Yeah, but that's, I'm talking about the big things. I'm not talking about the little things.
Okay, so to forget is to repress. So does that mean forgiving and forgetting are two different things, or forgiving means we ought to repress?
No, I'd say forgiving is not contingent upon forgetting.
Okay, the two separate things. And you can forgive without forgetting, is your suggestion.
How can you forget?
I would agree with that, and I would say if you forget, then you're losing the opportunity to learn and to make changes in your life for the better if you completely forget the incident.
Okay. So forgetting can be harmful to oneself and one's future flourishing.
To forget?
Yeah.
No, I think it can be positive.
Okay.
Again, it's the degree.
Doesn't the forgetting assume, or if you don't forget, but you think you have forgiven, your actions should be different. So in some ways, of course, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt's not going to forget. But if she has truly forgiven, then maybe her actions would be quite different from if the case was that she had said she'd forgiven but really hadn't.
Okay.
So I'm trying to make a distinction in terms of the actions there after the forgiveness.
Okay, so your suggestion is, well, we need to draw a line between these two. even if you remember what happened, that's not the test for whether you've forgiven. The test of whether you've forgiven is looking at the actions the person has.
I just said, if you forget, you don't have to forgive.
Say it again?
If you forget, you don't have to forgive.
Okay.
The bottom line is, if you can forget, if it's that little, that fiddly, you don't have to forgive.
Another way of getting at that is to say, forgiveness is a voluntary action. That's something we can do, something we can perform.
Yeah,
can you make yourself forget anything?
Well, let's say if you're a little girl and your dad sexually abuses you and you forget it, and then later on in life you remember it.
Then it's repressed.
I
wouldn't say call that forgetting. I mean, that's my definition. I wouldn't call that forgetting. I would call that repressed.
Yeah.
Being repressed.
But typically, I think we think that forgetting is something that happens to us. It's not something we do. It's out of our control. You either remember it or you don't remember it. That repression is by contrast in our control, and it's something we can do.
Actually, it isn't in our control, really. Well, it is to some extent, but not always.
Well, the issue is maybe not so much whether or not you remember, but whether or not you trust in that.
Okay, so let's get back. What Chuck raised for us and what you're alluding to now is, well, all right, whether or not you remember isn't the test of whether you've forgiven. Something else is the test of whether you've forgiven. Now, your suggestion is trust. Well, how do you know whether you've forgiven someone, or how do you know whether someone has forgiven you? What are the marks of forgiveness such that one or both parties can be sure that forgiveness has taken place?
I think it's a feeling you feel inside. Whether every time that thought crosses your mind or you're remembered, if you feel naughty and angry inside.
Okay.
If you don't feel that way, you probably have succeeded in forgiving.
Okay, so your suggestion is the test for forgiveness is, upon introspection, is there a feeling of anger, is that?
Anger or sorrow or
resentment.
Resentment or whatever.
So what we can suggest then is, here's what should normally happen in the moral life. When wrong takes place and the person who's operating, who's functioning well, resentment of some sort arises. If you do wrong to me, that should appropriately trigger resentment within me. And if it doesn't, I'm probably not functioning properly. That's the doormat example. If the wrong done to me doesn't trigger resentment, it suggests that I don't have enough respect for myself, enough self-esteem, so that I don't recognize a genuine harm, a genuine wrong being done. Likewise, if I observe a wrong or a harm done in the world, if that doesn't trigger resentment in me, then I'm not sensitive enough morally to see the wrong that was done.
I would tend to substitute the word anger, but on a lower level. I tend to think of resentment, maybe this is just my definition of it, of almost a stuffing of anger. And I think the healthier one is, the more one can go, oh, my gut tells me this made me angry. And if I don't deal with that and work through it, I will become resentful.
Okay. For our purposes, I think as long as we know what we're talking about. So anger is an appropriate response to wrong done to me or wrong done, right? And so forgiveness, then, your suggestion is that, well, all right, here's what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is overcoming the anger one feels at the wrong or injury that is done to one. Okay, let that sink in. Forgiveness is forswearing the anger or resentment, or overcoming the anger or resentment that one feels in the presence of a wrong done to oneself. Does that make sense to you? You buy that? Is that a good way of understanding forgiveness?
I feel like you're leading us down a path, and we're going to end up somewhere we don't want to be.
See, I've had that same feeling about you all.
The words overcoming, I'm hesitant with. I prefer the learning aspect, kind of that learning and working through, being informed by.
But okay, I mean, I guess, and you know, this is an appeal to your intuitions. When you think about forgiveness, how do you think about it? Is it the case that, if my wife does something that really irritates me, and should, she tells me to take the wrong exit on the highway. she navigates, I drive. She tells me to take the wrong exit. I get really angry at her. She says, look it, I'm sorry. It was a simple mistake. I'm sorry, I apologize. If after the fact I look and I say, I'm still angry, but I can learn from that. But I mean, isn't it the case that the anger has to disappear before I've really forgiven her? If I'm to be a forgiving person, don't I have to do something to eliminate and remove that anger? And if I haven't, can I really say I've forgiven her?
It's a letting go of the irritation. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where it's all the degree, to recognize that you also put upon her the responsibility to navigate when she's working with tools that may or may not be very easy to do. This just happened to me too. And you know, the you're tired, you know, the meter. I've never been there either, you know.
So it could be a case that what I end up doing is not forgiving her, but excusing her. She didn't have her reading glasses on because I had packed her reading glasses in the suitcase. And since she didn't have her reading glasses on, she really couldn't see the map appropriately. And so she really hasn't intentionally done wrong. And so,
I think that there's an element of letting go what really isn't that important. To miss the freeway exit isn't ultimately that important.
That wasn't a good example. I want us to get. Maybe she thinks I'm driving too fast, and she thinks by our taking the wrong exit, that will slow me down. So she tries to. Okay, and that. So that's a case in which she's intentionally done wrong, and she hasn't treated me with the sort of respect that's due me. She should have discussed it with the rest of me.
Melon, can we hear what you have to say?
I'm a little tired of these wives.
It's going to be a long time.
Okay. You're worried about being led down the wrong path. I'm worried at this point we're getting down some path.
You think you're doing that?
Well, you can guide me the right path then, guide my feet.
I wonder if the moral issue doesn't come into this forgiveness.
Say some more, go ahead.
Well, if it's a moral issue with us, what they've done, if that isn't more to forgiveness, you know, if, like, that's not really a moral issue, I don't think, going down the highway, and to me it wouldn't be a moral issue, you know.
Well, That's a good question.
I wouldn't need to forgive.
Well, that's a good question, and that's a helpful question to raise at this time. I mean, maybe what we need to do now, if we sort of get some sort of general agreement that, okay, what goes on in forgiveness is the person who has been wronged or feels that she has been wronged overcomes resentment towards a person. The question then that becomes, all right, well, why does that need to take place? Or what's gone wrong such that resentment is the appropriate response, a good thing to feel? Well, it seems to me that when wrong takes place, so what one is forgiving is a harm or an injury that's done to a person in two senses. Okay? In one sense, when I am wronged or harmed by another person, the person presents me with a set of consequences that I wouldn't have had to deal with and that I would prefer not to deal with. If I borrow Chuck Schaefer's fishing gear and take it up to a pond up the way, and then I end up stepping into a hole that's way too deep, and I become frightened, I abandon the fishing gear trying to get out, or let's say better yet, I'm just careless. It's a lovely day, I've got the fishing gear with me, I borrowed from him, but I decide I'd rather sun on the rocks than go fishing, so I put the fishing gear to the side, fall asleep on the rocks, the marmots come along and run off with all Chuck Schaefer's fishing gear. If I come back to him, well, what I've done to him is harmful. It seems to me that two things have happened. The first thing that's happened, I presented him with a set of consequences that he didn't desire. He's without his fishing gear now. That's an injury that's been done to him. That's a set of consequences he hadn't anticipated, hadn't wanted to deal with. But I don't think that's the only thing that's going on. I think also when we harm people, when we wrong people intentionally, it's a matter of saying something implicitly about their status. That we're not treating another person as a person with the respect that they're owed. That we're doing something that degrades them in some sense, that sets us over above them. So in the case of my wife, who wants me to slow down on the highway, and so she tells me the wrong exit to do that, there's a sense in which both those things have happened. Here I've got a new set of consequences I don't want. I've got to figure out how to get back on the highway from this place. And I've got to answer my kids' questions about why we turn off here. I don't want to deal with any of that stuff. But secondly, and in that case, it's a trivial enough example, but I think what gets it into the moral ballpark is that there's a sense in which she hasn't respected me as a person. She's degraded me by, instead of truthfully directing me on the way, she's manipulated me by deceit, and thus has degraded me, hasn't treated me as an equal. All right, so the import of that seems to me is this, that we feel resentment appropriately when those things happen to us. When someone else's actions are intended to present us with things we don't want for whatever reason. And secondly, when someone else's actions degrade us by not treating us as a moral equal. Appropriately, we feel resentment. Forgiveness is the overcoming of resentment under those circumstances.
Could it be, though, that forgiveness has to go beyond the overcoming of your own feelings or your own resentment, whatever, and it has to change your relationships in the future, whether it's with that same person or another person?
Okay.
It erodes on trust.
I think true forgiveness can't happen until relationships are healed.
Okay. Now, that's a good question. And this is, you mentioned the word trust. Now, you mentioned the word trust. What happens in forgiveness then, it seems to me, is that a sort of mutuality is restored. That the way things were prior to the wrong act, things are returned to that condition or that state. So an equality or mutuality is restored. I guess the question I have for you is this. Is it the case that that mutuality means that I've got to trust you in a way I had previously, that I've got to, So for example, let's say that I borrow money from you and I lose it somehow, it doesn't matter how, and the result is that you're not repaying the money on time, so you owe your creditors in a way you didn't want to, and so on. Now, I make amends somehow, I ask for forgiveness, you overcome your anger and resentment, you forgive me. The next time I ask for a loan from you, is it the case that you haven't forgiven me if you don't trust me with that?
No, you just learned a lesson. When you borrow Chuck Schaefer's fishing gear and you let the marmots run away with it, he's not about to loan you his fishing gear another time.
Well, can I say to him, well, then you haven't forgiven me, Chuck.
Well, you said that's your problem. You're carrying guilt.
Yeah, but how about Eleanor and Franklin? If she doesn't truly forgive, that always colors their relationship.
But she's probably not going to trust at the level that she had before.
Okay, maybe.
Rightfully so.
Maybe we can get a little more light on this if I read the passage. Maybe not. That's a great passage, and I want you to be familiar with it, this wonderful book. I don't know how many of you have read Ann Tyler's Synchrony. This is in the bookstore. It's a wonderful story. It's an account of a young man, Ian Bedloe, in 1965. Starts out his life in a very nice apple pie household, has great dreams and expectations for the future, and then as a result of saying things, his life enters deep tragedy. We'll read a bit about what he said. At this point, he's been wandering around one night. He walks by a storefront church, the Church of the Second Chance. That's the name of it. And there in the Church of the Second Chance, he enters in and says a prayer. And afterwards, he's talking with the Reverend Emmett, who's the minister, the pastor of the Church of the Second Prayer. And so here's the conversation between Ian Bedloe, who has this deep sense of guilt, and we'll find out what it's about here, and Reverend Emmett, who, as pastor of the Church of the Second Chance, has a way he proposes for Ian to receive forgiveness. Reverend Emmett studied him and says, "Your prayer," he said finally. "Was there any response?" Ian Bedloe replies, "Response? Did you get a reply?" "Well, not exactly." "I see," Reverend Emmett said. He watched an aged couple assist each other through the door, the very last to leave. And then he said to Ian, "What was it that you needed forgiven?" Ian couldn't believe his ears. Was this even legal, inquiring into a person's private prayers? He ought to spin on his heel and walk out. But instead, his heart began hammering as if he were about to do something brave. In a voice not quite his own, he said, "I caused my brother to kill himself." Reverend Emmett gazed at him thoughtfully. "I told my brother his wife was cheating on him," he had said in a rush. "And now I'm not even sure she was. I mean, I'm pretty sure she did it in the past. I know I wasn't totally wrong, but..." So my brother drove into a wall. "And then his wife died of sleeping pills, and I guess you could say I caused that too, more or less." He paused, because Reverend Emmett might want to disagree with him here. I mean, really, Lucy's death was just indirectly caused by Ian. Maybe not even that. It might have been accidental. But Reverend Emmett only rocked from heel to toe. "So it looks as if my parents are going to have to raise their children," Ian said. Had he mentioned there were children? "Everything's been dumped on my mom, and I don't think she's up to it. Her or my dad, either one. I don't think they'll ever be the same after this. And my sister's busy with her own kids, and I'm away at college most of the time." In the light of Reverend Emmett's blue eyes, which had the clear transparency of those marbles that Ian used to call ginger ales, he began to relax. "So anyhow," he said, "that's why I asked for that prayer. And I honestly believe it might have worked. Oh, it's not like I got an answer in plain English, of course, but don't you think I'm forgiven?" "Goodness, no," Reverend Emmett said briskly. Ian's mouth fell open. He wondered if he had misunderstood. He said, "I'm not forgiven? Oh, no. But I thought that was kind of the point," Ian said. "I thought God forgives everything." "He does," Reverend Emmett said. "But you can't just say, 'I'm sorry, God.' Why, anyone could do that much. You have to offer reparation, concrete, practical reparation according to the rules of our church." "But what if there isn't any reparation? What if it's something nothing will fix?" "Well, that's where Jesus comes in, of course." Another itchy word, Jesus. Ian averted his eyes. "Jesus remembers how difficult life on earth can be," Reverend Emmett told him. "He helps with what you can't undo, but only after you've tried to undo it." "Tried? Tried how?" Ian asked. "What would it take?" Reverend Emmett started collecting hymnals from the chair seats. Apparently, he was so certain of the answer, he didn't even have to think about it. "Well, first you'll need to see to those children," he said. "Okay, but see to them in what way exactly? Why, raise them, I suppose." "Huh?" Ian said. "But I'm only a freshman in college." Reverend Emmett turned to face him, hugging the stack of hymnals against his concave shirt front. "I'm away in Pennsylvania most of the time," Ian told him. "Then maybe you should drop out." "Drop out? Right. Drop out of college? Right." Ian stared at him. "This is some kind of test, isn't it?" he said finally. Reverend Emmett nodded, smiling. Ian sagged with relief. "It's God's test," Reverend Emmett told him. "So, God wants to know how far you'll go to undo the harm you've done." "But he wouldn't really make me follow through with it," Ian said. "How else would God know then?" "Wait," Ian said. "You're saying God would want me to give up my education, change all my parents' plans for me, and give up my education?" "Yep, that's what's required," Reverend Emmett said. "But that's crazy. I'd have to be crazy." "Let us not love in word, neither in tongue," Reverend Emmett said, "but in deed and in truth." 1 John 3:18. "I can't take on a bunch of kids. Who do you think I am? I'm 19 years old," Ian said. "What kind of a cockeyed religion is this?" He It's the religion of atonement and complete forgiveness, Reverend Emmett said. It's the religion of the second chance. He set the hymnals on the counter, turned to offer Ian a beatific smile. Ian thought he had never seen anyone so absolutely at peace. Cheap grace, the second part of the title. Reverend Emmett's not a proponent of cheap grace. You do wrong, you got to make it right. Is Reverend Emmett just for, is he just mistaken about forgiveness? That forgiveness is a matter of overcoming. And now we're shifting from the perspective of the person who has been done wrong to the perspective of the wrongdoer. We're shifting to the perspective of the person who wants forgiveness, not the person who gives forgiveness. Is it the case that wanting forgiveness is good enough? Or is it the case, as Reverend Emmett suggests, that that would be cheap grace to forgive someone who just wants forgiveness? That forgiveness is a sort of transaction between two people that requires more than just wanting forgiveness. In other words, what are the things the wrongdoer has to do before you, the person to whom wrong has been done, can appropriately, should appropriately offer forgiveness?
Corrective action, just like you've got listed there. In other words, if their actions have been destructive, then a taking of responsibility for that and corrective actions. Using your image of the fishing gear, it would be to say to Chuck, I am sorry this happened. I am fully responsible. Don't blame it on Lauren. And I will, please, you know, let's, you know, I'll write down a list of exactly what it was that you had given me, and I will replace it as soon as I can get out of the village or order it via catalog or whatever.
Okay.
Correct. That.
Why is that what's going to happen? Why, and you say you won't let me get away with blaming it on. Why can't I do that as long as I buy him new fishing gear equal in value to what I lost?
Because then you don't have a learning from it. If you avoid responsibility, you do not learn from the experience.
Why is it so important that I learn from the experience? Why isn't what's important that mutuality be achieved, and that can be achieved merely by my restoring appropriate fishing gear to Chuck? Yeah.
If you don't accept the responsibility, then the repetition of an action, again, is more likely. It's somehow similar related.
And I think early on when you're talking about then what should Chuck's response be when a month later you want to borrow his fishing gear again. His response then, if that's the way forgiveness has taken place, should be, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've reestablished the trust and his response should be, yeah. And that would be real forgiveness.
What if we weren't talking about fishing gear? Now, Chuck probably has very expensive fishing gear.
You wouldn't want to
see that. See, it would cause you some pain and some hardship, so you would be more careful next time, wouldn't you? Whatever you borrow, hopefully.
Well, I don't. Depends about what kind of person I am.
Yeah.
What if instead of borrowing his fishing gear, I borrowed his car and I totaled it?
That's still replaceable.
Yeah.
Suppose you borrowed his slides from Africa, the only copy he had, and lost.
Well, okay, so let's say I borrow his car, I replace his car, but next I say, Chuck, I'd really like to use, so now I've replaced his fishing gear and I've replaced his car. I say, Chuck, I'd really like to use your slides in class. What should Chuck, is if Chuck says, sorry, I don't think so, has he failed to forgive me?
No.
Or he could say, well, you give me money to make duplicates, then I will do that, and you can have the slides.
We've got to quit, but before quitting,
I have a point here. I'm getting back to, I've just been fixated on Eleanor and Franklin for a heck of a long time.
I wanted you to get fixated on Ian Bedlow, but okay.
Okay, but if... after the forgiveness, and correct me if I'm wrong, I understand that they really, really didn't have an intimate conjugal relationship after that point. So is it forgiveness on her part, or was Franklin being sort of two-faced about asking for forgiveness, knowing full well that he was going to run after the next woman that came along?
Good question, and we can connect that with Ian Bedlow, and this will be a way to conclude, even though we won't have really finished with this conclude. Typically, what needs to take place, we think, then, for the wrongdoer, before it's appropriate for us to overcome our resentment, it seems to me we need to see the wrongdoer somehow dissociating himself or herself from the action, somehow creating a gap. That, I know I did that action, I'm responsible for doing that, but I separate myself from that action. And typically that's done in one or more of four ways. First of all, repentance. Repentance is an internal admission. I did that, yeah, I am responsible for that. I can't be forgiven if I don't admit that. Secondly, after repentance is an apology. If repentance is an internal admission, apology is an external admission. I go to the person I've wronged and I say, I have done wrong, I want to be forgiven. Now, I think in standard cases, unless it's a very trivial wrong, that won't be enough. And that's what Reverend Emmett is getting at, I think. A third thing that's required is reparation. If there's any way I can repay the person, restore, eliminate that set of consequences that the person has had to endure, if I want to be forgiven, I should eliminate those consequences, return that person to a condition in life such that the person prefers those two situations equally, is happy with the way the world was before the wrong, but is happy, equally happy, with what I've done to make things right. Repentance, apology, reparation, and finally, penance. That seems to me reparation is a way of making right the consequences, but penance is a way of recognizing that I have harmed your status as an individual when I do wrong to you, and that I need to restore your status as an equal to me in some sense. That's not a great place to end, but at least that will give you something to chew on. So we better stop there. If you want to stay around to continue that, that's fine. But otherwise, thanks very much for your stimulating contributions and your help in thinking through.
Thank you.